Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I am hanging in there. Got a pretty bad cold, but otherwise, I'm doing all right.
All right. Well, you want to know what? If people are looking for one of those classic A Waste of Time with It's the Real intros, the kind that are like 10 minutes long with some funny anecdotes from our week that really go into who we are as people and as comedians, as working podcasters, you can listen to any of our other 217 or 18 episodes right on SoundCloud or Spotify or iTunes. Just go and listen to one of those blasted in your whip, windows down. People love to hear that shit as they're riding by. But today on the podcast, we have
Kenny Beats.
Kenny Beats, who is one surprisingly taller than you might expect him to be. He's 6'7".
You know what? That's why people tune in to this podcast, to hear how tall someone is.
Yes, very visual. Well, I mean, Cardo got wings, 4'11". He is a 4'11" man. Please add him and let him know that he is 4'11".
Here's why I like this story, Jeff. Kenny Beats is somebody who came out of Connecticut, which, you know, with all due respect to everyone in Connecticut, does not have a super, super hip-hop sound.
What?
And he made it out, and when he was just on the cusp of doing really well, he did Party for Schoolboy Q. He was in with the whole TDE. He was doing all right with the Johnny Shipes connection and everything over there. He decided to switch it up and dive fully into the EDM lane, and where he could have made millions upon millions of dollars and had a long and successful touring career, it wasn't where his heart was. And he decided to give that all up and dive right back into one of the most difficult positions probably to be in these days, which is hip-hop producer. And he's come out the other side with his reputation intact, his heart full,
and has become arguably the producer of the year of 2018, hopefully 2019.
I mean, if you listen to that Vince Staples project, you listen to his Key project, you
All are, Black, Rico Nasty.
Yeah. You get excited for his work with O3 Greedo and a lot of other artists on the way. It's a great story. It's truly exciting, not just because
he's tall,
but also not just because he grew up 10 minutes from us, which is wild. And our one and only intern, Dave, from 2010? 10? 9? 9, something like that. He hipped us to his classmate, Kenny Beats. And here he is all these years later, sitting down with us. Shout out to Dave.
But before we get into the actual episode with Kenny Beats, I want to recommend three episodes that you guys should check out. I want to recommend episode number 107 with Alex Toumey.
I'm sure everybody knows Alex for his work with Young Thug being his engineer, but he's also got an amazing sense of humor and tells the best stories about, like, when his parents moved him secretly down to Florida, when he moved to Atlanta and ended up being a poker-playing studio intern, like how he ended up negotiating his whole thing with Birdman. There's a lot of great stories with Travis Scott, with Kanye West, with all the producers in Atlanta, Metro, and Southside, and TM88, and it's just a lot of fun. It's a great episode.
Episode number 93 with Johnny Shipes.
One of the funniest episodes we've ever recorded. Everyone knows Johnny Shipes from his cinematic music group. Obviously, you know his association with Joey Badass, but maybe you didn't know that he worked with Foxy Brown and Sean Kingston and was out there in the Hamptons throwing parties, that he got kicked out of military school. There's so much to laugh at and so many incredible stories from that one episode. Go check that one out.
And the other arguable producer of the year, episode number 144, Cardo Got Wings.
Shout out to our guy Cardo, who, when he came up here, we just knew he was a funny guy from Twitter. Obviously, we respected his work with everyone from Jay-Z to Jeezy to Taylor Gang to Wiz to Travis Scott and Schoolboy Q and Kendrick Lamar. But he's one of the funniest guys we've ever met and has one of the craziest journeys to date. Check that episode out with Cardo.
So yeah, listen to those three episodes and 215 more on Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud. Everywhere you access a podcast, it will be there. Go check out A Waste of Time with It's the Real. Leave a comment. Subscribe. We read all of them. We appreciate all of them. Even the 4-star reviews.
Jeff, I only accept 5-star reviews. When do you want to get into this one?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. Back Like Cook Crack, a.k.a. Humpty Dumpty.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. Triple Beam Lyrical Dream, a.k.a. a haiku.
I'm Kenny Beats. Hey, man. Say, man.
Yeah, this is your third favorite podcast, A Waste of Time with It's the Real.
Kenny, what's happening?
I've been paying attention to you guys since high school.
No, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, what's crazy is that you're not still in high school.
Yeah.
Okay. Because no. I wanted to, like, you know.
But you were saying that you used to ride the Metro North train down to the city for your internship alongside our intern, Dave Snopkowski.
Yeah.
You guys both went to high school together.
Yep.
And you ended up working for a situation in a major, major record label.
The Suits.
In a major building. Dave worked for us in our apartment.
I just remember, like, I would leave and me and Dave would be on the train. He'd be like, dude, Jeff and Eric, like, they're so tapped in. Like, and I'd be like, yeah, like, I was like getting together like demos of Jordan Sparks CDs to like mail out to people or whatever. And he was like, yeah, dude, like, we're like on the nose of what's going on. I'm like, yeah, like, I'm a label intern.
Dave was our best and only intern. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's so, him. Oh, yeah. So he could also be our worst. Like, he definitely stole stuff from us.
Fire.
We were teaching him stuff and we're just like, here, have some books about like rap. And then we were just like, do this. And it was great. We had a great time with him.
Give us back our books.
He owes us. He owes us significantly. You grew up in Greenwich.
I did. I don't like to talk about it.
No, okay.
We go Cardinals.
I always just say Connecticut.
Yeah.
I'm already facing a lot of people being shocked that I work with the types of artists and the type of shit I work with. So like me then saying Connecticut, which no one has a point of reference for anywhere.
Well, unless people love Stu Leonard's.
Yeah,
well,
there you go. Yeah.
I mean, it's a couple things. Like, unless you're from New York City, like, Connecticut has no like reference point for most people. So when I say specifically even Greenwich, it's just like,
well,
what?
Like, what's your favorite hedge fund? Just sorry, top five. I don't want to make you put you on the spot.
Yeah, you don't want to feel weird about it. Yeah.
Oh my god.
What exit off the merit?
Who's
are you?
Who's the dude? That dude Ray Dalio. He owns like the biggest one, right?
Who's that? I raged with his son. Ray Dalio.
I raged with his son a couple times. That's for sure.
How did you end up getting that internship? This is the one with Johnny Shipes, right?
No. I interned at RCA and stuff first, and Johnny was like a completely just. I was doing that on my own for no credit.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah. So when Dave was interning for you guys, I was interning via the high school for J Records and for RCA. And at that time, Larry Jackson from Apple Music was at J, and his assistant was John Eamon, who's at Interscope now, who signed Lana Del Rey.
Yeah.
And so, like, I was under those guys, and they were the shit. Like, so talkative and so cool with me, and, like, so, like, they explained everything to me in such a way I could understand. And, like, seeing them now crush it. Like, I ran into John a couple years ago, and I was like, dude, like, I don't know if you remember me. I was your intern. Like, you were an assistant, and he totally did. And it's like, he's the VP of A&R now or something.
How
shit.
Could people not remember you? You're 6'7".
Maybe that's it.
Do you remember me? I was the one who was lurking behind you.
Towering over you at your desk. Yeah.
So did you know anything about the music business before you started that internship?
Not the business, no.
Did you know, like, what you would expect from an internship in a building like that?
No. Honestly, I got so lucky because I had gone to school for years and years and years with a girl who I always just talked music with casually because I was always super into it. And when I was about to do an internship, she's like, hey, my dad could probably get you an internship, like, in the city. And I was like, oh, cool. Her dad was Tom Corson.
He
was the president of Sony at that time. And then now he's, like, works at, I think, Universal or Warner or something. Yeah. Like, he's a big boss.
Right.
And so, like, he would come over to my little, like, intern desk and be like, hey, you want to, like, grab lunch? And I was like, oh, so I got laced.
Oh, my God.
But that's another thing about Connecticut. It's like, I don't like to use those, like, you know what I mean, relationships and those kinds of things.
For sure.
Because I feel like you already have so much to prove coming out of Connecticut trying to do, like, authentic rap music from anywhere else in the country that it's like, I'm not going to give you any card to pull.
Oh, my God. I know you so well.
Yeah, I bet you
and
do.
And we just met.
I bet you do.
Did you think that you were going to go into, like, the business end of
No, I thought that it was a smart kind of plan B to show the parents and the mom and kind of everybody that, like, okay, I'm doing this label stuff. Maybe I'll try to work at a label until the beats work out.
Okay.
Until the music pans out for itself.
Well, when do you start producing?
Like, 15 years old. I was bringing my parents, even though I lived in Connecticut, I never had a house. I had lived in apartments with my mom and dad separately. And, like, I would have any kid from, like, Porchester, New York, or for anywhere else in Connecticut, like Bridgeport, like whoever who I heard about who was rapping, who was my age, come to my dad's house, and I'd record them on a blue snowball microphone. Like, basically, how we're doing this right now, right into my computer, you know what I mean? And make all the beats around it, like, try to produce it, whatever. And I was just doing it literally instinctually then. And then I started making more beats. I got a couple placements in this, and then I started doing this other stuff. And now I've come all the way back to literally doing exactly what I did at, like, 16 years old, just at a different level now.
Sure. Yeah. At 15, what are you listening to that sort of influences your sound at the time?
Well, I got really lucky just that my dad's an audiophile. Like, my dad has tapes and CDs and vinyl beyond compare. It's pretty ridiculous. And so he never made music, but he like went to broadcast school and was really into DJing and just all that kind of stuff. So I was playing guitar since I was a little kid, listening to anything you could play guitar to. Classical music, rock music, a little bit of jazz when I got older, this and that. But the only stuff that was ever relevant to my friend group that anyone ever cared about was rap and
yeah.
hip hop. And you know what I mean? I grew up in like Cisco Thong Song when I was like in fourth grade. Like, that's 2000 rap music was what I was really listening to with my friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But by myself, it was like, let me go play guitar. Let me go listen to jam bands. Let me go have this metal phase. You know what I mean?
Were you in bands?
Yeah, a little bit around town, but nothing like, we never really gigged or anything like that. I wasn't in a band that actually played a show until like I was at Berkeley playing guitar.
Oh, you didn't play like Arch Street?
I did play Arch Street. No, I definitely did. That's where I grinded for the first time. So I remember going to Arch Street and getting like, I remember St. Lunatics came out. And like they had the Nike, the Air Forces where the toe matched the check. Mm-hmm. And it was like so hard to find them. And I went to like Fordham, like got those, had a Clippers jersey and like pulled up to Arch Street and was like, I'm about to grind to Little John.
Oh my God.
For 3 hours right now.
And they were like, do you play for the Clippers? When did you have your big growth spurt?
I was always the biggest kid in my class.
Wow.
In high school, there was kids who were taller than me, and I always played basketball and shit, and there was a couple kids who were bigger than me in high school, so yeah. I kind of got to, like,
yeah.
not be the weirdest dude for a minute.
Were you a gentle giant?
I like to think so.
Or were you the guy who, like, on Halloween would just terrify kids just walking around?
Nah, that's definitely not me. I mean, I started smoking weed at 17 and really chilled out.
Yeah, just, like, mellowed out. Yeah.
I was much more, like, had a lot of flagrant fouls in basketball when I was younger, that's for sure.
So when you were playing guitar and you're listening to a wide range of things, did you teach yourself guitar? Did you listen to the music and then just like figure out the notes? God, or
this, like, y'all keep just exposing the land. This is gonna get lamer and lamer. So no, when I was 12 years old, I was in a breakdance class after school.
Wow.
In Connecticut.
So wow. This is going to get lame.
So I would, after school,
we're just going through all the elements right now. Yes, go on. Yeah.
There was this dude who was like from the high school, and they were like on ESPN, like breakdancing, like crushing it, like actually super good. And like they would come after school, and I remember they play like the new Missy record, and I would be like top rocking like in the cafeteria.
Oh my God.
This dude was like, this dude, Max Gale, who actually now works at Def Jam, still a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And Max the homie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Max was like, you know, like Dr. Dre like plays all the drums on these songs. And I'm like, wait, but he's the artist. Like, he's making the beats. And like, it never occurred to me before Max that like, oh my God, people make the beats. So I got MTV Music Generator at 13.
Oh man.
At 15, I got GarageBand, fake Fruity Loops at home.
Yeah.
Then like by high school, there was a class called Electronic Music. And if you crushed it in GarageBand enough, she let you go into Logic. And so I got into Logic at school only. I didn't have it at home, nothing. I was 16 years old, and I would stay after school and do anything I could to get on that computer that had Logic on it, and I would remake Timbo snippets from the Black Album.
Wow.
So you remember that video of him in the purple room with Jay-Z?
Yeah, for sure.
He plays like the potion beat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, right, and exactly,
like,
yeah.
And like some Brandy song.
Yep,
like,
yeah, yeah.
But it was like he was trying to play stuff for Jay. I would roll that YouTube clip back 1,000 times in like the media lab at the high school and be like, doing the flute, like the same notes.
Oh my God.
The,
yeah,
the
yeah.
MIDI, right? And then I go play that beat and not tell anybody about the snippet and be like, yeah, it's just my first. And it's like this crazy, like Timbo melody, and like my drums are smacking. And I'm just, but it, that's how
would you
I,
go
like,
the full route and get like a juice jug and just like do that full like Timbo dance? Yeah.
In retrospect, I should have.
So when did you stop breakdancing?
Right when I found out that info about the beats. Like, that was a very short-lived career. There is a video of me, though, in middle school doing like a Michael Jackson routine that's fire.
I don't understand why you're not putting this on the internet.
Maybe not yet. I'm still letting the white thing settle in for a little bit. So
when did you become white?
It's been a minute, dude, honestly.
Wait, but is that a weird thing for you that like the internet just like cannot understand that you are in fact white? It's like when Jesus revealed that he was black.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's more about the fact that I embrace it so much, because mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a lot of other producers out here who have people say similar things or whatever to them, and they're just like either respond trying to roast the kid or ignore it or whatever, and I'm like, I wait for someone to tweet something about me in the race war, and then I retweet it, and I'm just like, this is insane. And the more I do that, the more it happens, which is good or bad, but it's become a thing to where like it's another recognition factor, and it draws people back to the music. And at the end of the day, the point of the whole, oh, can't believe you're white thing, is because people are hearing me try to nail a style from a certain niche part of the country or whatever, and they're like, I haven't heard some random lanky white kid do a beat like this that actually fits the swing and this and that. or just a kid who's not from here do a beat like this.
Yeah.
So to me, it all leads back to the fact that people are stoked on the music.
Totally.
So I embrace it.
Yeah. We were invited out to dinner at Guy Fieri's restaurant. So do you remember it was in Times Square and it had the worst review ever by the New York Times? Sick. It was like legendary how bad this review was. So we were invited by a friend who also invited maybe six other people and Chrissy Teigen out to dinner at this restaurant knowing that it was going to be terrible, right?
Random.
And so Chrissy followed us on Twitter at the time and still does, but back then we were just like, we hadn't met her or anything. She comes in and she makes her way around the table and introduces herself to all the people, and then she makes her way over to me and she's like, hi, I'm Chrissy. I'm like, hey, I'm Eric. And she goes, you look really familiar. I was like, oh, well, you follow us on Twitter. And she just sort of goes, and then walks like all the way around the table. And I was like, man, I just fucked up whatever like friendship we could have with the woman.
And so like, you know, we're not talking to Chrissy throughout the dinner. You know, she's talking to other people. And at a certain point, I'm just like, this opportunity is like slipping through our hands. Like, this is our one chance. Yeah. And so me being the herb that I am.
Jeff starts breakdancing.
Yeah. I pulled out my phone and I tweeted at her.
Right.
And I was like, which is like the worst, the worst thing you could possibly do. But I show her, I was waiting for her to get the notification, and she looks down, and she continues her conversation. I'm just like,
She like looked around. It was just like,
and so finally I pull it, and I basically like shove it in her face, and I'm like, hey, like I tweeted at you, and she goes, oh my God, are they here?
And we're like, damn,
and we're like, oh no, we're it's the real. And she goes, oh my God, I thought you were black.
We were like, I guess I could see that. So yeah.
How did you feel?
Seen.
Yeah.
I felt visible for the first time.
Yeah.
But now she introduced us to everybody as her black friends.
Yeah, we went to John Legend's 10th anniversary Forget Lifted, right? Party. Yeah. And we were in there and there's all these celebrities and we're just like, what are we doing here, right? And then Chrissy pulls us aside and she introduces us to Kevin from The Office and she's like, these are my black friends, Eric and Jeff, and we're just like,
how? There's no context to that, by the way. Yeah. So now he's just like, okay, sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Kevin from The Office.
That's when it's the worst, when people like super know you, perpetuate it.
Yeah.
Like I have all these people I've been friends with for years tweeting, like, oh, I didn't know Kenny was on. I'm like, dude, like you're making it so much worse.
Dave Snopkowski saying that. Like
bro.
So when you're doing that internship, that was your senior year, right?
Senior year, yeah.
Yeah, you're doing that internship. What did you gain from those months that you were there?
Honestly, just my first kind of bearings into like what the difference is between what's going on with all the stuff I'm encountering in real life and blog wise and things that I'm running into at Santos and in studios and hearing about from my friends and this whole other world of like corporate shit and all these artists who you haven't heard yet who have $10 million behind them because this label knows they're going to be the next thing. And then in 6 months you find out about that artist with your favorite artist on the song. And you're like, they've been planning this. Like it was the first time I ever got the scope of what was going on more so than just like making cool songs.
So did you work around with all like the marketing team, the A&R team, the promotions people?
A little bit, but I will say like the Jay internship and everything was super boilerplate, and getting with Johnny Shipes for no school credit, for no money, for no anything, like immediately after taught me infinite amounts.
Well, how'd you meet Johnny?
In a studio. Austin Rosen, who works with Post and a lot of people now, like Frank Dukes, like he gave me my first studio time ever when I was like 17 years old. And I believe it was like 48th and 9th or something like that. And
sounds about right. Checks out.
Nipsey would be in there. Currency would be in there. Frenchman Montana did all of Mac and Cheese, like 1 and 2 in there. And so I'd be sitting in this back B room and recognize everybody and be like, oh my God, like maybe I can get in there for like a minute and like smoke a blunt or like something, you know? And Austin, who owned the studio, was always super cool to me. So there were times I got to be in the A room and be around stuff and hear songs before they came out. And Neo the Matrix was the in-house producer, which is so random.
Yeah.
But and I saw him in a grocery store in LA recently. It's crazy.
Really?
Yeah, crazy.
What was he getting?
Organic, boneless, skinless chicken thighs.
Oh, it's so dope.
Very, very Neo.
Fire call. fire call.
That's going to be a very good TMZ headline.
But yeah, like I think with Johnny, like beyond the introductions and meeting people and being more like just on the floor around stuff I was paying attention to, what got fucked up was the most important lessons of that. And it's like, I'd get sent to a bank to make a deposit for somebody and not have the right routing number and then not be able to reach the person I needed to reach, or like be downstairs at something where I had to get up to the fifth floor, but I didn't know who to call to get up there. And I had to be somewhere in 10 minutes. Like, that's what made me like understand that you just got to push shit through.
Right.
No matter what. You know what I mean? Whether it's on the music side or the business side or whatever, it's like, there's a lot of intangibles.
Yep.
And you kind of, when you do the label internship first and you kind of don't know anything, you're always like, oh, so all this stuff's going to fit together. If I do a beat, I'm going to get a contract.
Right.
Like, if this happens, they're going to credit me. Like, that. I started to get my bearings a little bit. And then I dipped and I went to Berkeley.
So just before we get there, I think in general, there's a lot of, we get hit up by a lot of producers who are just like, yo, can you put me in touch with different people? Can you do this for me? Can you tell me how to exactly run my life? And a lot of the times, you can have the talent, but it's about how you get around the millions of roadblocks that exist in this business, because at the end of the day, a lot of people are not going to care about you, the person. They're going to care about the bottom line and what they have to do to please the guy who's above them or the guy above them and their artist who doesn't give a shit about any of you.
Yeah.
And it's just like, how do you get around that? And you learn that at a young age.
Yeah, make yourself valuable. And like, to me, now I preach about like the difference between a beat maker and a producer.
Yep.
But back then it was more about just like being valuable in any capacity to get around the type of shit you want to get around so that you're paying bills doing music and not some other regular shit. Mm-hmm. And I'm 18, 19 years old. And I'm like, I'm doing music, period. So if I got to work on the label side, or I got to be an assistant, or I got to do beats, or I got to do whatever, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So like the Johnny thing started to give me a little more cutthroat perspective and started to make me realize like, you really got to speak up and you really got to get out there and you got to have an opinion and you got to be on top of shit and you got to be organized. And it's like all that stuff changed me forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
At 18, 19, did you know that like maybe people wouldn't return your phone calls? Did you accept that like maybe this was just like a fact of life?
Totally. I think when I got to Boston and even LA later, like people were surprised at how like OCD and intense my mindset was from just being like, nah, like, they're not going to call back, so you got to make sure you do this. And then if that doesn't happen, we're going to go this route and we're going to hit this person. We're going to go, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's just almost like New York mentality in a cliche way, but I really feel
really Connecticut mentality.
Connecticut mentality. But I feel like to this day, I'm very much like, I'm thinking about the 30 roadblocks that are possible before I even start the conversation. So if the conversation goes great, great.
Yeah.
But it's like, I'm thinking this is going to be war from day one on any record or any business deal or whatever. Yeah. I'm like, you're coming at me trying to play me,
right?
Because when you're a kid in New York City, it's like you can do beats for 1,000 hot people and not get a dollar if you don't stand up. You know what I'm saying? And it's like I saw a little bit of that when I was young, but I got pulled away from all the rap stuff into this whole other world for a little while, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But like that really gave me the wherewithal to come back to what I'm doing now. And that stuff didn't happen when I was younger and I didn't have this perspective, like I don't think I could do nearly what I'm doing now with all the artists I work with, because you have to have that happen to you so you can learn how to get around it. You know,
for sure. Obvious.
That's a bar. Why did you end up going to Berkeley? Because like that's a music school, and you know, you're sort of already in the music business by this point. And so, what is going to music school do besides? I mean, maybe it was just to please your parents, or I mean, you know, what?
My mom was not letting me do anything if I didn't get college done. Like, and I owed that to her. You know what I mean? For taking care of me. So it's like,
do you
like,
have any older siblings?
None. I have 36 first cousins. My dad's one of 13.
That's so too many.
36 first cousins.
Yeah, I have a really big family.
Yeah, but is Thanksgiving crazy?
Yeah, if I go to theirs, I'll have my mom and my mom and cook or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, like it's insane amount of people. But I was an only child, and honestly, like,
let's do it. Let's get deep.
I forgot where I was going with it. Actually. I got emotional. I lost it. Jeff looked me in my eyes. I didn't know where to go.
You wouldn't be the first person to cry on this podcast.
That's right. That's right. So you went to Berkeley because...
Yeah, I went to Berkeley basically because I'd been playing guitar my whole life.
I've
been playing drums for a long time. I knew that there was some kind of electronic production major there or something, but I really thought like, okay, I want to do this music shit. This is where some of the best people business wise or music wise go.
Right.
And it's not classical. It's contemporary.
Right.
They really do focus on what's going on now, or at least what they think is going on now in jazz music.
Yeah.
Whereas most people, you go to a music school, it's a conservatory, it's classical.
Right.
And so I went there and on day one, I realized like, wow, there's no one here who has the mindset I have
right.
like at all. And I had one other friend who was kind of into rap and like kind of made beats and stuff. But besides that, like all my friends were instrumentalists and like virtuoso, unbelievable musicians.
Which you can speak the language, but
yeah, but,
yeah,
it's,
but
like,
it's a different.
Right.
I mean, a lot of those kids today play open mics,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, because it's like you spend so much time perfecting your craft and your instrument and all these master classes and all this stuff. But it's like, have you written a song?
Right.
Do you know how to sell this song? It's hard out here for rock bands right now. It's hard out here for a lot of people. You know what I mean? So like throughout Berkeley, always felt like, man, yeah, I could have not gone here and I could have just kept moving in the city how I was, how so many people do. And I still think about that today, knowing producers who are my age and have plaques on plaques. And I'm like, man, if I went straight through, something similar would have happened. But being at Berkeley that whole time, I felt like, man, like I wish I was back in New York. I wish I was around all this stuff that's going on. But while I'm here, I'm getting game that none of my peers have.
We had similar experiences too. Like, yeah. I went to Syracuse for film, and like right from the jump, I was just like, I need to get a step like ahead of all my competition. And I just had this drive where I was like, but I'm going to use school and not let school use me.
For sure.
And so that is what I ended up doing for 4 years. And I did have an opportunity too. So I interned in the city for a music video production company and film production company. And they just had like amazing things happen. And they asked me after that semester was done, or after that, you know, period of time was done, if I would quit school and just work for them full time. And they had a Sundance award-winning film happen. They later on went to do HBO shows and all this other stuff. And it just, if I took that opportunity, yes, my life would have been one thing, but all the stuff that I learned at school through my doing led me to where I am today.
Totally. Yeah. And I also think it was kind of like not just school, but that age. And I was removed from New York City at that age into Boston, which for me was a great thing because it was kind of like, there's not a popping of a scene there for rap and for a lot of things.
No, not at all. And when were you in Boston?
I graduated in 2013. So like the 3.5 years before that, basically. I lived on Boylston and Mass Ave, like right in the middle of Back Bay, near all the college, near Berkeley.
Well, yeah, I mean, you were right by Berkeley.
Yeah.
I went to BU.
Okay, for sure. Down the street.
Yeah, and I feel like there might have been more of a Boston scene when you were there, because there was not one when I was there. Like that, totally. I was there when like Eminem fans beat up Moby, and like that was like the biggest.
That was the big hip-hop thing.
That was the biggest hip-hop thing that happened. Yeah. Like, but nobody would come through. I saw like some 41...
We saw Green Lantern perform.
Green Lantern was there, but like, you know, it was just like, it was not a city that rap fans really cared about. And that's not to say anything bad about Benzino, who is a loyal listener to this podcast.
And shout out Static Select, a shout out Cousin Stiz.
Thanks.
But like, at my time, it was like like underground hip hop was a store there, and it was all very backpacky as far as anything that was going on there or people paying attention to. And like, I felt like I had like this little one up of having my own little epicenter in Boston where I'm kind of honing my craft and kind of a step away from New York and can see everything that's going on. And I was selling weed. So basically I would hit up any producer I had met on my MySpace journey, or I was on Twitter when I was coming back and forth from my internship every day. And that was 2009 Twitter. You could really reach people.
Oh, yeah.
You could really get in touch with people's managers and shit. You know what I mean? If you tried hard enough.
Fabulous responded to everybody back then.
Exactly. Like, so I was just kind of in Boston, and I would hit up any producer I knew, being like, yo, I heard Schoolboy Q's coming through. Like, didn't you do a beat on one of his albums? Is there any way, bro, if they need weed or whatever, I'll pull up, just trying to make myself useful.
Smart.
Any
smart
way I could get around. And it's like, what do you don't need me to pull up and play you hot beats while you're on tour. It's like,
right.
What
the fuck? Or do they?
But you're making yourself known useful. And you're useful. They will not forget
depending
you.
How good was your weed? Like,
it was
honestly
fire. Oh, was it really? like to this day, I've had full page spread in High Times. Like, I'm a connoisseur. I was getting fire.
Wait.
He worked
full page
with Johnny Shipes.
That's true. I guess you weren't like selling like dirt and being like, hey.
No, that was part of my tagline to Johnny. I was like, bro.
Not dirt?
I was like, dude, I listen to all of your artists and I sell fire ass weed and I'm just down to be around. I'm not worried about any kind of smoking or anything.
Like, I'm not a narc, said the narc.
I pulled up the first time I ever met Johnny. He was sitting with Smoke Dizza in his apartment, and I pulled up and just brought out all these different types of weed. Like, my first 5 minutes, they're like mad uncomfortable. Like, didn't know how to like be myself. So I was just like, weed. And then I played like 3 beats, and the first beat I played became a Smoke Dizza song.
Oh my God.
Wow. Wait, so that quickly?
Oh yeah, first beat I played. And it became Continental Kush Breakfast by Smoke Dizza, which you can look up right now.
Yeah.
I was on 10 Smoke Dizza projects.
That's so dope. Yeah. He's the best, by the way.
He's the homie. Sean is my guy.
Yeah.
What was it like the first time you saw him like not write anything down?
I was only at a couple studio sessions. He used to record in Harlem at like Bodega Bam's spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd only go to a couple times when he was recording, but he was just such a good friend to me as a young kid. You know what I mean? I didn't realize he was not that much older than me.
Yeah, which is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. He looks so much older.
Totally.
But yeah, like Johnny and them, like from day one, basically showed me that there's a lot of people who are around in studios and here and there and this and that, and they might make music, they might, may not, but they make themselves useful another way.
Yeah.
They may be a runner, they might be whatever. And so in Boston, I started to create this culture of like, if a rapper's coming through who you know and you know me, let me know, I'll pull up on them. I'll either give them weed or I'll just, whatever they need. If they need something else in the city or they need to find food or whatever it is, I'll pick them up. I don't care.
Were you Kenny Beats?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was. And so.
Well, when did that start?
Kenny Beats started in like high school, like 16 years old. Like,
so no other names?
No, never. It's just, it was Kenny Beats.
Like, consistent, always. Yeah.
Yeah, my first MySpace was Kenny Beats, and then since then. But I met Danny Brown that way. I met Schoolboy Q that way. I met Absol that way. I got close with the ASAP Mob that way. I met them out here. I met Stevie out here. I met 12 out here. But they came for their first show outside of New York to play Middle East in Boston.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you go to my camera roll, like, you know the first picture you ever took on an iPhone, like at the back of your camera roll,
The
second picture is like Rocky holding a 12-ounce Profit sticker for me.
Wow.
Because I was working at that graffiti block.
Yeah.
And so I was literally at their first show outside of New York and got super close with Lou and with Ferg before Ferg had even really dropped like that. And it was all via me being the one kid in Boston who a couple people knew off the internet.
Right.
And so I met a lot of people there, and everyone thought I was from Boston for a while.
Well, you do look white.
and I'm Irish. Yeah, yeah. And they all met me there. But yeah, like that, as much as I wonder what would have happened if I just gunned right through, I feel like that kind of created my story a little bit and started working my name in a different way to where, like, you come to this one city and you got someone you really fuck with in that city. To this day, I know, like, if I go to North Carolina, I got two homies there, basically.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But they're going to take care of me, and so they're valuable people to me. I'm always going to have them in my phone type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's how I created value initially. But, like, the story that really was, like, the craziest thing that I wouldn't even believe if someone told me was I hit up this producer, Rock, R-A-H-K, and he produced on Overly Dedicated for Kendrick and a lot of early, like, TDE shit. And I was like, bro, Q has a show. Like, this is right when Habits came out. Schoolboy Q had a show like at Middle East or something like that, and they were doing a shoe signing at this sneaker store called Laced, and I knew about it, and I was like, Rock, do you know anybody? I'll pull up, like whatever they need. And he was like, yeah, they're probably gonna need some weed, bro, like pull up. I went there. Absol had not dropped Control System yet.
Yeah.
So Ab was well known and had a name and this and that, but he wasn't really doing the signing. So Q was in front signing all these kids stuff. Someone came and met me, brought me around the back, and Ab was just chilling in the back, and I was an avid Absol fan. Like, could really tell him all his lyrics, all the songs he dropped the last 3 years, and who produced it. And
not that he wanted that.
Yeah. No. Yeah. But I'm saying, like, I was very versed in his music before meeting him, so it wasn't light for me. It wasn't like, oh, this is another dude who's with school. It was like, I'm a fan of you.
Yeah. Mm.
I gave him the weed. I was like, I'm not even going to ask for any money. I was just like, if maybe I'll get the smoke.
Right.
Whatever. Yeah. He was the coolest. We smoked. He took his glasses off, which for him is a rare thing.
Sure,
any fan would know. And we just talked, and eventually it got to where I could just interject a little thing about, like, yeah, but on this project you said, and he'd be like, oh, so you really pay attention kind of thing. And at the end of us leaving the sneaker store, I was like, dude, I have two beats on my phone. Like, I'm not trying to be the worst, but, like, I have these headphones. Like, dude, would you just listen? And I, so many
kids. Wait, were you prepared for him to say no?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Fully. Because, like, you know, nobody wants to hear beats.
Yeah,
totally. Like, ever.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Okay.
Facts. So I was already of the mind that I'm going to probably go here, dap up Schoolboy Q and give them a bag of weed, and then maybe they'll give me a ticket to the show or something.
Right.
Yeah. That was like the realistic scenario. The best case scenario was like, I end up being your guys' in-house producer for the rest of your career. But I,
and telling them all their lyrics.
Yeah. And I can tell you all of your lyrics and what they mean. But Ab was like, yeah, bro, whatever. Like, I just gave him a bunch of weed. He's been doing nothing.
Yeah.
Listen to the two beats. The first beat was Schoolboy Q Party. The second beat was 100 Stacks, Absol, Q, Mac Miller.
Oh, wow.
And the third beat was Smoke Dizza and Absol Diamonds.
Yeah, so pretty good.
So I gave Ab those three beats, and he placed all three for me. Like, he got me a Schoolboy Q placement. I gave him the beats.
Wow.
It became my first TDE song. And that was off selling Ab some weed and playing him some beats.
So did you trade, like, numbers?
Yeah.
Okay. And and later on, he would hit you and just be like, by the way, this beat has gone here.
Dave Free called me 2 months later and said, bro, we're dropping Schoolboy Q Party tomorrow night. What's your info? What's your producer name? Do you have a publishing? And I'm just like, just drop it.
Yeah.
I just put my name on it. And that started my relationship with Mix by Ali, who actually just mixed Vince Staples' whole album.
Yeah.
And Ali's like a good homie of mine. And I sent in that beat. They were mixing it. they added a I wanna rock to the hook, and it didn't make the project because the sample couldn't get cleared.
Oh my god.
And I still tell Ali to this day, I'm like, bro, you owe me bread.
And so who were you musically at that point, do you think?
I was a rap producer. I was like just out here listening to the earliest TDE shit and listening to like Currency and listening to like everything that was going on at like the DD172, Dash. Like it was that era.
Yeah.
And so I was
Pilot
like
talk to and
So it was, I wouldn't want to say like I was into like the weed rap scene or whatever, but I was definitely into like the more like, I don't know, like hippier, kind of smoked out druggy kind of rap shit. As
Cloud
well
rap.
As well as ASAP.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
Kush and OJ and,
exactly. Yeah. That era. So I was making all those type of beats by myself in my dorm at Berkeley. And trying to get them off however I could. And I started to get all these placements towards the end of Berkeley. And then right when that happened, I dipped from rap music.
Okay. So did you graduate, cross the stage, the whole thing at Berkeley?
Yeah, but this whole transition I'm talking about had already happened before I graduated.
Right. So after you seemingly leave Boston, where do you go?
I left Boston before I graduated because... And I ended up graduating Berkeley and like coming back and finishing everything. But I left because a kid who I was friends with at Berkeley knew I was doing all this rap stuff. And literally that song, Schoolboy Q Party, had come out this month that I'm talking about. And this kid, so I was like, to me, I'm like, it's starting to happen. It's starting to bubble up. I'm working with my favorite rappers, da, 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 da. And this kid was like, dude, look at this. And showed me some video of like Bauer or like RL Grime or like Flossadamus, one of those dudes. Mm-hmm. And was like, this dude got like 10K to play this show last night. Like, listen to what he's playing. And then played me a beat, and it was like some simple 808 shit with like a real weird, like wobbly kind of synth on it and nothing else. Like maybe one little like Biggie vocal chop or some boring acapella they like put in. And I was like, this kid's making 10 grand a night? Like what? I was like, I just signed $1,000 iStandard hip hop contract to give away my royalties for life on a song like 2 days ago.
Just like you learned at RCA. Yeah.
Like what are y'all talking about? So I started just kind of, I never knew anything about EDM or dance music or raves or anything like that. You know, I'd been going to rap concerts when I was a kid and like rock stuff. So I started just deep diving into it, specifically what was going on with like this rap mix of like dance music. And I knew in my mind, like it's somewhat contrived in the sense that kids are calling this shit trap and it's not, and people don't understand the lineage, and it's like Swedish guys using 808s for the first time. And like, what is going on?
Right, yeah.
But I saw a lane where I was like, I can crush these kids. And like, this shit's fun. I'm 21 years old at this time, 20 years old. So I'm like, this is going to be fun. You know what I mean? So I just start making the weirdest shit I can make on the same kind of drums I was already doing and just chopping all kinds of acapellas and just being so OCD. Dude, in 6 weeks, I had been flown to LA, had 10 meetings, had gone to all these people's offices. Someone's telling me like, what do you need next year? A car, a house? Like, what's going to make you happy to move out here? It's like within 6 weeks. And I had been doing all this different rap stuff, breakdancing, doing all this bullshit my whole life trying
graffiti.
To figure out.
Yeah. I think we touched on every. Did you
all
ever rap?
5 points? No, never rap. Okay. I never will. Yeah.
Do you want to rap right now?
I'm good.
Just a quick 100 bars.
But basically, like.
They offer you the world.
Yeah. All in 1 second.
When to I started, do something that was not what you had been working on.
And it wasn't
so
like I went from like doing TDE stuff to like making techno. No, I was making hard ass rap beats, just putting weird shit on top of them instead of vocals.
Yeah.
Instantly. I'm playing festivals and I can pay my rent and I can help my family and I can do all this different stuff that I never could do ever before off music. And my friends in college would see me like with an MCM backpack and some Jordans and whatever and be like, oh, he just produced like a song for Q. He's killing it. And that was all weed money. That was all like me selling weed, trying to look the part kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until like the DJ stuff happened that it really started panning out for me in the music industry. And then I really got a grasp of all the stuff from the internship, the stuff from when I was younger, like fucking up in music, and I didn't know about, I got an agent, I got a manager, I got a business manager, I got a lawyer, and you would instantly go, oh. And as it went on, I got really into it at first and then slowly started to realize like, wait, if I get hit by a car tomorrow, kids aren't going to know me as Kenny Beats. Kids are going to know me as this DJ.
And so why did you change your name?
Because it was a duo. Initially, the DJ project I was in was me and another guy, and then I ended up taking it over. In the last year or so, I've like done it by myself. But like almost 2 years ago now, I just had this epiphany of like, this is not me. Like, this is not what I truly am excited about and truly want to make for the rest of my life, and not what I think I'm the best at either.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I can be real with you. I think I was like a C, B level DJ. You know, I'm not like ranking in Skrillex bread ever in my life. But when it comes to this rap shit, in my mind, like everyone does, I'm thinking like, I will smash on these top 10 producers right now.
Right.
Put me in that room. You know, right. But I could not prove that on my computer. I just thought that shit. So I was like, okay, let me make 500 beats. Literally. Like actually 500 MP3s of all different tempos of Oakland shit, Texas shit, Chicago shit, whatever I'm missing. If I hear Drunken Love in the radio and I don't have that drum bounce, like I need that tonight.
Yeah.
And I started doing that. While this whole other thing, and bro, I'm making money doing music. Like, right. I'm not asking for pity here. It's like I'm playing festivals and doing all this stuff to pay my bills, but I knew like this isn't it. So I started making all this rap stuff and not really telling anybody. And I went through some depression for real. And I was just like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you're making all this music and all this stuff, and things are going all right, and you can help your dad out and this and that. But like, do you really truly want to be doing this? And this is really who you are. And is this what you do? Your friends don't even listen to this music. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't you want to play shit in front of your homies where they go, what? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
So I'd stopped going out and I stopped partying. And I stopped trying to fuck girls and I stopped trying to worry about anything. And I was like, I'm going to lock myself away. And a lot of my homies were real worried about me because, bro, I was waking up sad every day. Just like, I need to push this line along. I need to go do something to change what's going on with me. And halfway through that process, my best friend at the time, Mike, I was managed by Dexstar. They do Blink-182, Steve Aoki, all this big shit. My homie Mike, who was managing like a couple other acts and stuff, came through the studio and was just like, dude, like, what are you doing with all this music? And at that time, I literally had hundreds of beats. And I'd been working with tons of producers, with the Ear Drummers kids, with like TDE producers, with all these different people who had known me from when I was younger or I knew now, but I'd not played a single beat for an artist, not taken a single meeting, not tweeted about anything, no plans. And Mike was like, bro, you need to start playing some music for people. Like, you have a lot of shit here. Like, take these 10 meetings. I don't care who your manager is. Just go take these meetings. I did. Right off the bat, people were like, bro, like, what, do you want to get in a session? Like, do you want a pub deal? Like, what are you doing? Like, let's do something here. And I started talking to Mike about how I want to come back to this and how I don't want to be a beat maker and how I don't want to send emails to really hot rappers and get a one song on a Migos album and how I don't want to worry about the money first. Because it's like, if I can somehow pay my rent right now, that makes me 10 times more fortunate than most of my favorite rap producers. Because those dudes got to do a Nicki Minaj placement this month to make sure things are above board.
Right.
Because they already spent that pub money on whatever the fuck else, real life or jewelry or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, if I can come back to this and really just make things that excite my friends, and in my gut, I know like this is something I can play in any room and be proud of, everything else will come. And it was so bad at the beginning of last year. I don't mean the music. The music was coming along great. But like Mike started managing me. I left my old manager. I left all this comfortable shit, all this money, dropped out of a lot of stuff. And January 1st of last year, I had about $1,000 in my bank account. And people always go, well, weren't you DJing? Weren't you doing all this stuff? Yeah, I was. I paid all my owed taxes in like November, trying to be a good guy, like trying to catch up on years of not paying my fucking taxes. So I paid a big lump sum. I was like, okay, I still have a little bit of money for like Christmas gifts, this and that. Then my split happened with the DJ stuff. It was amicable. It was all cool at first, but there was just a lot of money and a lot of bullshit that went along with it. And then some family stuff happened all at the same time, which everybody can understand. So I came down to the last $1,000 of my savings. And it wasn't like the taxes thing. Maybe I could have pieced out and done a payment plan. But besides that, that other money was not, it was not possible that I wasn't going to have to spend that. And so I was sitting there with like $1,000 in my wallet. I just made this big transition. I had just produced a whole project for Pablo Juan. So I was already moving. And people were like, who's this fucking random kid in LA doing a Pablo Juan? Right before he signed to Gucci. Like, yeah. When Pablo was real rapper's favorite rapper shit, yeah, in Atlanta. And so shit was starting to go. And I'm like, okay, I can see the music's coming. I can see people see what I'm doing. But I have $1,000 right now. You know what I'm saying? And like, this authenticity shit and all this is cool. But I've always preached to people, pay your bills first.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Make sure you do what you got to do to pay bills. And then everything else will come when you have time to work on it. But like,
that's a crossroads
for sure. And it was really, really hard, dude. Like not being able to buy your mom or your girlfriend or anybody a Christmas gift, you know what I mean? And thinking you're doing this all for the right reasons, but it's just putting a mountain on your head. And slowly this one little rap check came in and it got me through the next couple of days. I didn't take a dollar from any of my friends who tried to lend it to me. Then me and Keith started working. Then I started just having more things kind of pop up. And I also was still doing this like 12 hours a day. That never stopped. I got healthy and I got a girlfriend and I started like living my life a little more normally than I was, mm-hmm, when I first transitioned, but I still was going OCD hard every day. And by February, I was on my feet and I was good to go. And by April, I was like, this is starting to kind of shape up how I wanted it to. I'm working on a couple of different projects with a couple of random different artists and I'm doing the whole thing. And I'm really proud of all of it. Then by May, it was like, okay, I'm in my bag. And then it's the rest of the year, I'm just like laser focused. I'm like, now I've proven to myself that you don't got to do all this other lame stuff to, one, show your worth, and two, pay your bills. You know what I'm saying? And like now I feel like I'm in a position where I've showed and proved like my mentality at least a little bit this year. And so all the opportunities that are coming now, like I don't have to direct so much bullshit and say, I don't want to do this for bread. I don't want to do this. It's like the things that are coming to me now are the kinds of things that I've attracted with that energy.
Hey guys, just want to interrupt this podcast
to let you know that Eric is still so, so very sick.
I am sick, but there's two things that I'm not sick of, Jeff. One, love songs. And two, presents.
Presents are the only things that will heal Eric, and you can get all of them from itsthereal.com/shop. Go and get yourself a Rough Riders and It's the Real collabo t-shirt, or even our AKA t-shirts, which are in purple and black, or you can even get our rhyme book, the rhyme book that we put so much work into, which is perfect to slide under your Christmas tree, that Christmas tree we've been hearing so much about all these years.
These are the only things that will make me feel better, guys. Go buy yourself a t-shirt or a rhyme book
from us at itsthereal.com/shop.
While you're out there on the road and you're DJing, we know that all the negatives that can come with it, and that did happen. But what did you actually get on a from a positive standpoint from that experience out there? Like, even musically?
How to put on a show. How to put on a show with real production. Like, how to play a festival. You know what I mean? How to manage money when it actually starts coming in musically. Just how important a business manager and a lawyer are. Equally as important as your manager in a lot of people's cases. Like, it taught me like insurmountable amounts of production knowledge, because those dudes are the best producers in the world. You can sit down with a lot of these EDM guys who make four on the floor, like dancey music, and say, I want something to sound like this string in this 1 second of this Motown song. And they will pull up a vinyl emulator and three other synths and make you the string that you wanted to hear in the song that you liked for 30 years.
Yeah.
It's that crazy. So when I come back to rap stuff, you got to apply some of it and you got to use it to your advantage. But as soon as you become one of these dudes who learns all this stuff from doing all of this DJ things and all these other types of music, and you start trying to apply like those techniques to some young hood energetic shit with a lot of momentum and say, let me clean this up. Let me just, let me make sure this vocal's not so distorted. Let me kind of just like move this stuff a little more on beat. You miss the whole point.
Right.
And you're getting old and you're not understanding what's going on here. And so it was this weird dichotomy when I came back to rap music of like, let me understand what's really going on with the swing and the bounce and the sound of these records and how they're recorded and where and why, but also try to elevate these kids with what I've learned. Because I feel like I really can talk to kids about the music they're making and then show them like, but imagine if you had this toolkit. Imagine if you could do this with your ad-libs. Imagine if you da-da-da-da. And like, that's how I build the relationships I have.
One thing that's really interesting about you is that you are a producer, not just a beat maker. But the idea of being in a studio working with an artist, vocally, thematically, whatever it is, and you do a lot of that with artists. You're not mailing tracks to people. Ever. You want to be face-to-face and create something with them because they bring something to the table and you should bring something to the table. And what you create together is hopefully a better product than just what happens via email, right?
Yeah.
Who's the first artist who you work with who you can like sort of have that relationship with to sort of set the tone for everyone that would come later?
It was Pablo Juan.
Well, how did that come to be? And then how did you find that trust, the two of you?
I had known a dude who worked at Backwoods, because with the DJ stuff, my name as a DJ was Loud Pack, which is like a weed euphemism, obviously.
Yeah.
And so we had all these like brand partnerships and all these weed companies wanted to get down with us because we were the only dudes in the EDM world of like super nice Eastern European guys who were down to like smoke weed on camera and shit. So they're like, oh, let's like bring you in. So I knew a lot of people in weed and I knew this Backwoods dude.
None of the guys who wear like the giant like, you know helmets. Like hotbox those things.
Yeah. They're not down.
Okay. Gotcha.
But,
understood.
So wait, where was I going again?
Juan.
Oh my God. You are such a stoner.
I'm so hot. So basically I knew this dude from Backwoods and I'd seen he's been with Pablo all the time. And like the dude from Backwoods could get in any studio, cause it's like, he's the dude from Backwoods and dudes want free Backwoods and he always had free weed and this and that. And so he'd been with Pablo a ton. And at that time, like Yams knew Pablo. Pablo's been around for a while.
Yeah.
If you look in any old Thug video, you'll see Pablo in a white tee with a short haircut right behind him. You know, same way you'll see Gunna, same way you'll see a lot of people.
Yeah.
But Pablo at the time, like, his music just really excited me. And I was also thinking about like, okay, I'm working with a bunch of different stuff right now. I haven't dropped anything, but what's going to be the thing I come back out with? And it wasn't like this big orchestrated marketing statement. It didn't say it in any of the press about the project. It was like, oh, Pablo has a project with this kid. But for me, it was like, how are people going to see this reintroduction? And it was important to me that the first thing I did was something that was important where it's from. And I feel like at the time, Pablo really had this like kind of mystique and buzz about him. And there was nothing about it that was like super, super deep or super, super like insanely lyrical, but just Pablo was had this juice at the time, and just everybody just had so much fun when his music was on, and I loved the beats Danny Wolf was doing for him, and I just thought it was all cool, and I was like, man, I could make this go crazy. Like I have some ideas. Like I have vision for him, not just I want to get a hot beat to him because he's hot. I told the Backwoods dude, like, bro, if you pull him up to the studio, I swear I'm gonna kill it. Like just bring him once. I had just gotten my current studio where I do everything. I've done everything this year at.
In LA.
In LA. It's Ron Artest's old studio, Meta World Peace.
This short, him. Yeah.
But it was like where he started Meta World Peace.
Yeah.
You're the first person to smoke in that room.
You think? But it has a booth. Yeah. It has a recording booth. And I knew little to none about vocals. So I had bought the equipment when I got the studio. But the day Pablo came, they're like, all right, Pablo's pulling up. And I had asked a couple days, and I thought it was going to be a whole process, and maybe it would happen, and da-da-da-da. And they're like, he's going to be there at 3 p.m. And I was like, okay, there's no way I'm going to be able to call an engineer. There's no one to be able to like to work this out. I just started YouTubing for the next 3 hours, literally. And I knew enough to record a vocal, but I didn't know enough to be real fast in the computer and about a lot of effects and sends and all this other shit.
Yeah.
Mixing vocals is 10 times harder than making beats, honestly. But Pablo came in. We got through the first song, and he walked out of the booth and said, we're doing a tape. And it, like, I didn't have this notion of like, I want to do a project. I want to co-brand it. I want to do Kenny X an artist. None of that was conceived. It was just, I want to work with Pablo Juan. And I think if people start seeing like me coming back to doing shit like that, they're going to understand what I'm about. And this isn't about getting big placements and just doing rap shit for the sake of saying it. It's like, I really want to be a part of what's going on that I care about. And so he said, we're doing a tape.
How much of a relief was it that he said that as opposed to you proposing it?
I was like, what? I was like, me? Like, seriously? Like, I couldn't believe it.
You were like, I didn't even get to like screw up your vocals yet.
I was excited. And we worked the next day. And after day three, he like walked out of the booth the same way and was like, the cover going to be me in the Kenny from South Park outfit. And it's going to be Pablo Juan, Kenny Beats, South Dark. And he just said that. And there's 10 people in the room hearing him say that. And I'm like, all right, I text Mike in 2 seconds. Hey, bro, Pablo Juan, South Park figure in the Kenny thing. We got the artwork back. Pablo saw the artwork. He was like, oh, this hard. Like, you already know it's like some Glory Boy shit almost. It's like just the cartoon shit. If you've done the right way, and like it can be really, really cool. And he loved it. And we immediately were like, okay, how do we shoot a video? We need to get a mansion from one of the homies or someone to get let us in somewhere. We need to get a car. We need to do all this stuff. And we put a video out that did 1 million views. And then we put this whole project out that we split 50-50 with us and Hoodrich. And we put out all this different stuff. We're like, we're really working alongside him to put out a project. And my name was on it. And then Pablo's doing, you know what I mean? It wasn't me saying, let me put this Kenny on here.
Right.
I would have been happy to do a Pablo Juan project. And then you just see produced by Kenny Beats everywhere. He put my name on that cover. And so at the time, it's like, you couldn't really have more people that you'd want looking at your page than Pablo in like the Atlanta rap scene. He put that up and people started being like, man, this don't sound like the other shit. It sounds different. And I think going back to now, like if I was with Pablo, I would have approached it 1,000% different. But at the time it was just about, let me not give him trap beats. Like, let me not give him the quintessential shit that he's already on, but let me give him a bounce that's comfortable. Just let's make sure the harmony and the music and all these other things are elevated, and let's try to do more with his vocals and da da da. That was the point. And so,
well, what would you do now then?
It would be just the beats would be different. Gotcha. And my vocals have come so far since then, and like all this other stuff. And like the project did well though. And he signed a Gucci immediately after. Mm-hmm. I followed up within a month flying out Lil Wap and doing a whole project with Lil Wap.
Right.
Because I had seen this video of Lil Wap in Gucci's projects with the Gucci face tattoo. And I was just like, this kid is nuts.
Yeah.
Just on some like, we could make the scariest new dark 21 feeling shit, and it's like you can't pull Lil Wap's card. People know he's a demon from where he's from. And so we made the whole Lil Wap project. He signed a Gucci right after that,
and you're
so
like,
I was like two for two. Yeah, I was like 2 for 2, and people were looking at me like, that's crazy. And then immediately after that, like, I was like, okay, I'm doing all this Atlanta shit. Like, I need to step away from Atlanta. Like, now let me move on to a different thing, but let me keep this same ownership as far as the projects go. Let me keep the same authenticity to what they were already doing and the types of beats and the sound, but let me keep showing people that, like, when I get involved, it's going to be this different thing.
Yeah.
And then Rico Nasty and Key and Greedo and Freddie and Uno and Youngboy and all this different shit started happening at the same times. And, like, mind you, between Pablo and all that stuff happening, I went through that period of, like, being broke and, like, being really stressed that if it was going to work and anything. But what kept me going the whole time was, like, my homies were bumping that Pablo shit wherever we went in their cars or when they were alone, and people sending me videos for the first time, bro, since I was 19, for the first time, people being like, I'm bumping, bro, that beat hard, like, da 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 da. And I was like, this is what I've always done it for. It's like my homies were never bumping my DJ shit in their car, like, oh, put that on, put that, you know what I mean? Like, that's my barometer.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure the same with you guys. It's like, you guys know too much to be around someone who doesn't have good taste.
Right.
It's like most of my friends, there's so many conversations and so many people work with so many different types of artists and stuff that, like, if one of my homies comes to me really excited about something, I'm definitely going to give it more than a listen.
Yeah.
And vice versa, if I can impress my homies, I don't care about the tweets. I don't care about the check. I don't care about none of that. It's like, it was this different feeling for me that I hadn't felt. And after going through that depressed year of coming back to making all the beats, to going through the money getting fucked up once I started getting the beats out, like, the music started speaking for itself. And it was this feeling, bro, I can't even explain.
Well, let me ask you a very serious question. Are the Eastern European DJs looking at you like, man, this guy used our culture, and he's a culture vulture of EDM?
Wow.
I haven't had one comment of that at all. A lot of those dudes I've seen, because I'm finishing up, I have one show left as a DJ, and I don't think I'm gonna do anything super. I'm gonna just play real hard.
That's the most disappointing answer you possibly had.
I don't want to make this whole statement and everything. Like, I don't. I'm just gonna.
It's just gonna be you, like, pressing one button and walking away.
Basically, came in how I went out. But
you know those like movies where it's all, you know, it's like based around a heist and they're just like, oh, I had one more and then they pull me back right in. You know, that's gonna be you.
Exactly. This is my Italian job.
Yeah.
But yeah, like those, a lot of the DJs I've run into, dudes, like, I just did Lollapalooza and Bonnaroo and a couple things left as a DJ, and like dudes are coming up to me who I didn't even think knew who I was as a DJ, being like, bro, I can't believe like the shit you're doing, like, da 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 da. It's like Skrillex just liked the video of 10K Cash hitting the whoa on my page yesterday.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, that's crazy to me.
Yeah.
Because I was in a world for so long where I was like trying to do this one thing, and as soon as I dipped from y'all, all those dudes are like, hey man, love what you're doing, you know?
The Key project, the Rico Nasty project, I'm sure, you know, the Freddie, all these people come to you, but it's not like, you know, with all due respect to like Tim or like Swiss or whoever, like, they had a sound that people were just like, I need that sound, but you're here and you're like, no, I want to do something that's specific to you, artist.
Yeah.
Did they come to you for your sound, or did they come to you for that experience that they were going to have with you?
Right.
I think they come to me for their new sound. I think they come to me for like where they want to go, because I'm not pushing an agenda clearly of the type of beats I make or my sound,
right,
or anything like that.
Right.
My agenda is make my favorite artist's favorite song. And so like someone like Rico, like...
How well did you know her?
Not at all.
Okay.
And I'd been a fan of her for about a year.
Wow.
She had her second song she ever put out was called Hey Arnold. And she knew Yachty from Vine. Like, they knew each other off the internet. And she had, like, kind of semi-popping, like, page or whatever. And Yachty was already promoting, like, her stuff and putting her stuff out and getting on her remixes and stuff really early. And that must have been how it got to me. But my friend played it for me in a car, like, at Coachella or some shit. And I was like, how is this not every girl's anthem? Because she's speaking about shit that, like, Uzi and Cardi and a lot of dudes speak about, but in a very female-centric perspective.
Right.
And, like, I love this so much. So anytime for the next 6 months that, like, my girlfriend or one of her friends or anybody be like, oh, what are you listening to? I'd be like, listen to this girl, because I know you haven't heard of her. And like, it's amazing. Like, she's so good. But she was so sugary and so bubbly. And it was Sugar Trap was her brand and her project. And even the videos were like so animated and like very just like internet-y, you know what I mean? Tumblr-y anime kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And so I get to the studio with her and I'd been like just tweeting her. And like a lot of people think that like, I'm just all the time like getting plugged from my, like this person or like I met this rapper. It's like I tweeted Rico cold, just like, please, can I please play you beats? Like some dumb shit. Like literally something like that.
Please follow. Please DM.
It was, I think, like verbatim. It was
come
like,
to Brazil.
Can someone please tell Rico Nasty I have so much shit for her? I think that's what I said. And I'm pretty sure she like liked it. And then like nothing happened. And then like 2 a.m. that day when I tweeted that, I just got a DM. I said, pull up.
You know, I'll sit there sometimes and for one project or another, in some scope of our career, someone will not work with us for one reason or another, right? And the person follows us on Twitter. It's Chrissy Teigen, okay? I'll just say, yeah. No, but like I'll think about like adding them on Twitter and then I'll think about the response. And this is like my own like insecurity in that yeah. moment. But you didn't have that insecurity where you're just like, fuck it. Like I want to work with this person. Let me just put it myself out.
I don't know you. Like, right. I'm going to know you less.
It's right.
Like,
right.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah. But with Rico, they said pull up. And almost just by the kind of way the DM was sent and how it looked, I don't know how to explain it. It was just like, this doesn't sound like Rico sent that. And I got there and there was a bunch of people there. And Rico, which is in the studio, is not this like loud, gregarious, insane, screaming girl that people on the internet like think she is. She's in the studio in a hoodie with no makeup on, smoking, just like, I need to get inspired. And she's just sitting there and like, there was dudes cooking up. And when I walk in the studio and I see an artist sitting there and a beat maker making a beat, my thought is normally a negative connotation. It's normally that you played a bunch of shit and none of that shit went off. So you're now like creating something to spec.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas I make shit all the time just off the bat. So I hope some people don't think that when I'm making beats. But either way, like I walked in and I was like, okay, she's not feeling what's going on here. Let me just ask her. And to this day, people I've worked with 1,000 times, whether Rico comes to the studio tomorrow or I meet someone for the first time today, I'm going to just say, what do you want? So the first thing I said.
Wow, you're like a barber.
Literally. So Rico was like, I played her a Sugar Trap beat. The most quintessential Rico, like a poppy, bubbly ass thing on some trap drums. She went and like reluctantly like did a verse to it. And it was like, cool. It was all right. She came out and she's like, almost in like trying to test me. Like, I want heavy metal. Just like bratty. You know, and a lot of people think that was my pivot to make Rico all aggressive. She's like, I want metal. Like, have you ever heard of Death Grips?
You're like dog.
I'm like, all right. Yeah. Like, so I'm just like, all right, let me cook, whatever. And I started to realize Rico, much like a lot of artists, has a team and has a manager and has an executive producer and has a boyfriend and has a lot of people around her. And a lot of dudes think like they're DMing Rico Nasty and talking to Rico Nasty. Or when you're in the studio and say, Rico, do you like this? It's everything is in her mind and she's formulating the whole project. She has a team of people who she really trusts and who are really close to her. And if she does a bar that's weak, those are the people who look at her and go, Rico, say that how you're supposed to say it. You know what I mean? And in some situations that shit can be detrimental, but in hers, it's the opposite. And they're the people who make the Rico moments that we all love. And the time you hear her say a certain thing, you're like, oh my God, she's raw. Those are her friends being like, come on. Like, I started having conversations with them on day one with Malik, who's quintessential to Rico, to her friends, like to all the people who were there. And I realized real quick, every time you play a beat from Rico or you say something to her about something that could change in a song or whatever, she goes, oh yeah, cool. And then she looks at Malik and then Malik will go like, or he'll go, yeah, or he'll go, whatever. You know what I mean? He'll make a little face. And so I started talking to Malik and we just started talking and he really is her executive producer. They work on a lot of stuff together. And so I realized real quick, like this is not just about the artist. This is about the whole movement and everything behind her. And if I'm just focusing on Rico or in a lot of other cases, just the artist and let us be best friends. Let me understand what you're trying to do. And I'm here for you. Dude, it's more than that. And if those people who are sitting right behind her, who have been a part of every other important song or whatever, let's go studio session, and you're ignoring their input or their like ability to change the situation and make the song better, you're not doing your job. Because you're focused on the artist and you probably have some weird intention, or you're probably just trying to get the hottest song out without figuring out the real way to do that.
Right.
I made her a metal beat and I didn't even get 10 minutes through it. I had an 808, I had a snap, I had a hi-hat and a guitar and like nothing else. And I was like, all right, I'm going to add some effects. I'm going to do this. I'll sequence it. So there's some interesting parts. The beat will change. She's like, load it up. And I was like, I do not know this girl. I'm not going to be annoying. I loaded it up. It wasn't done. That was smack a bitch.
Wow.
And she didn't. And from the conception of like, I want metal to the verses and everything being done, maximum 20 minutes. Max. Like start to finish the whole thing. And that's how you hear it on the record too. And then she went back and did ad libs. And Malik the whole time was just coaching her through the vocal. And he, and like after we got it done, he was like, man, like, Kenny, you just walked here and did that. And I thought they were just gassing me. I was like, oh, this is dope. This is cool. And I left. And then she beat the shit out of a girl rapper on Instagram Live a couple days later and then dropped Smack a Bitch. And her fan, all her bubbly, internet-y, kind of like Tumblr-y fans were like, what is this aggression? Like from our like super like, you know what I mean? Like princess who had never stepped in this like really insane zone, and all of a sudden her whole momentum changed.
Oh my God, you ruined her life.
But it was, that's me listening to her.
Yeah.
If I had an agenda, you know what I mean? Like it wouldn't have worked out.
How does O3 Greedo come into your life?
I show Key O3 Greedo's music because I just thought it was amazing. 3 weeks later, Key FaceTimes me at 6 a.m. from a gas station in Atlanta, and him and O3 Greedo are wearing matching sunglasses. It's 6 a.m. in Atlanta. It's 3 a.m. in L.A.
Yeah.
And I'm at the studio still. They FaceTime me. They're wearing the same sunglasses, and they're both like so, like, you know, a kid who like doesn't know how to use FaceTime? FaceTime like so close to his face. It's like Key and Greedo, and I'm just like, I'm like, oh my God, it's O3 Greedo. Like, Key, what are you doing? Like, Key, I showed you his music. Like, y'all don't know each other. And then Key was like, you and Greedo doing a whole project. Like, coming to LA tomorrow. And then they just like hung up. And I was like, what? And then like a day and a half later, I got a text from a random number. And it's like, it's O3. What's the address? And I had other sessions. I had stuff booked. I had all kinds of shit. Yeah. I was just like, here's the address. And he pulled up. Mike, you were there. My manager was there the first night we did it. And Greedo walked in. Pull up a beat. All right, cool. Walked in the booth, did a whole song, walks out of the booth, goes, do y'all know what I'm talking about? And I'm listening to it, and I'm like, well, I understand this bar. I understand, like, this bar. And he goes, the shoes I'm wearing right now are, what are they called? Kevin Bradley's. They're a Nike SB for a skateboarder. I date her cousin, so he gave me these shoes. But he really be on some gang shit. So the bottom of this one red and the bottom of this one blue. So when I said, when I get bored, I'm talking about a skateboard, I get back at it. I'm on the grind, like da 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 da. Like when I make a flip, I get back in traffic. His whole song was skateboard metaphors, but you wouldn't have gotten that because how would you? I know Kevin Bradley's signature SB Nike skate sneaker, and he was wearing those shoes. He walked in there, he did a whole song with all skateboard metaphors, just talking some street shit. And the song's called Off White, and you would never relate it to skateboarding unless someone gave you this little tidbit.
So now you go to Absol and you're just like, yo, I thought I knew what you were talking about.
But like, that was the first minute of Greedo. Like, the first four, he had made a song in his first 5 minutes in the studio and came out and just was like, y'all, none of y'all know what I'm talking about. Here's what I'm talking about. Like, you know what I'm saying? And I was like, oh my God. And then we made three songs that night and they were unbelievable. And then we didn't stop working till he left. And I was there before the trial. I was there when the trial happened. I was there when he had a gun charge, when they dropped the gun charge, when all through the whole thing before he proposed to his girl, like all this different stuff. And like, just saw every different mind state he was in. And he put it all on wax at the studio. Like everything he was thinking, every weird, insane thought you might have about going away for a long time or about any of the things he's experienced. And like, I just watched all that happen. And some nights he'd come out and he'd explain it to me and he'd give me context and he'd help me like realize how important these songs are to him and to other people and this and that. And then sometimes it'd be very somber and he'd go in there and he didn't have to explain shit. And he'd do a whole song about doing life or about something. And you just sit there and like, he'd be like, all right, next one. And we would just go through me and Greedo and no one, him, a gun and me in the studio and no one else for many, many, many nights. And he would do minimum 8 songs, 9 songs, 10 songs.
So in the end, he recorded how many songs that he turned into the label?
From what I know, it's 2,000 plus.
So seemingly, the music will come out, you know, appropriately at certain points.
It's divided up by projects, from what I understand. So there's a lot of producer-centric projects. There's a lot of thematic projects. He has collaboration projects with artists. And it's some shit you would never expect, but it's a lot of music.
But okay, say one of the projects you worked on comes out a year from now. Yeah. And a year from now, musically, you're just like somewhere else. Is there a possibility that you would go back and tweak any of the music that you made? Or do you want to keep it that way because that's how he recorded it?
I would never touch a thing he did. I might go back and mix a beat differently. I won't vastly change like the landscape of anything. But I will for sure apply like new shit I'm learning and make it sound better. And my thing with Greedo was the biggest disagreements we ever had were about me trying to mix and master his music. And you can tell by a lot of stuff I do that I'm fully okay with doing some stuff that sounds like real hard and simple and to the point and isn't perfectly mixed and mastered. I'm okay with a lot of stuff like that if it fits what's going on. But with Greedo, I was like, you're writing some unbelievable songs, like not just the hard Greedo shit or not just like the sexy like lady records. Like he was writing some really introspective, really important records to the kind of shit where I'm like, I'm gonna listen to this in 30 years. Like I'm this is gonna be important to me the rest of my life that I was even able to help you with this. I want to mix it. I want to do this. I want to do that. And Greedo would just be paramount about how that's not what his music is. And we wouldn't not mix things. We would touch things out. We would do stuff. But like, it would get to a point sometimes where he would be like, bro, I created a sound off making my own shit and I like it to sound raw and I want it to feel this way. And da da da. So we have a project called Netflix and Deal and we have a shit ton more music. And Netflix and Deal is basically just about his favorite movies.
Hmm.
So we have a song about Blow. We have a song about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. We have a song about Pocahontas. We have a song about Blue People where he discusses Lilo, Stitch, Avatar, and a couple other movies. Like we have an in their fire Greedo songs. We have a song called Maria about Maria Full of Grace that is just like a smash.
Wow.
Like, and it'll all come out, but I don't think I'm doing him justice if I don't help educate people to that. And, mm-hmm. and he calls it creep music. His genre of music that he invented is called creep. And that's more specifically like the darker, like the Never Bend kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. creep music and it's like truest form. But when we made Street Life for God Level or we made Basshead, which are just like, that, one of those is me and Boys Noize.
Wow.
Talk about European producers.
Like, yeah,
Boys
right,
Noize
yeah.
made the 808 on a modular synth and gave me the 808 and I have O3 Greedo on it. Like how weird of a combo is that?
Yeah. But
Greedo's like, this is the new creep music. Like, this is how, oh my God, we just invented this. I have videos and quotes of him talking about this. Like, this is the new creep music. Da, da, da. And he was getting to a point where he was ready to start taking on like newer, harder, different kinds of mixes, different kinds of sounds, different kinds of producers. And I think in the last 3-4 weeks before he left, he went to work on that. And he finished many projects in the last 3 weeks with a lot of people. And all of a sudden it was like Mustard and Pump and Hit-Boy and all these different people, like finally like Greedo was opening up to like, let me just go do whatever with all these different people, you know?
Wow.
And like, I just can't wait for people to hear it. It feels like working with Max B or something. You know what I mean? It was like such an insane time. I knew how important it was, but hopefully we see Greedo a lot sooner than people think we're going
to
see him.
That's such an intimate experience for you to be like, you know, you and him and he's like, you know, pouring his heart out and you're, you know, doing your part as well. And you're just like, you know, going to war basically together. Like, talk about what it's like to see your friend go away.
It's like, as much as he's my friend, it's just like he's so important to so many people, you know? And you see that in California and you see that in LA and you see that when you talk about him. Like, there's no one like the dude. And really, from a musical standpoint, like being fortunate enough this year to be around Thug and be around like unbelievable professionals at recording, like, Greedo will write you a really deep, really melodically interesting, like really catchy song in 3 or 4 minutes in 2 takes. You know what I mean? And it's like, I just felt like every time we were in the studio, I was like, I can't believe this has a time limit on it. You know what I mean? Let alone the music, our friendship, any of it. It was just like, I learned so much from him as a person that like, it's hard to reconcile with stuff you hear that's like going on in his past or what he went in for. Because when you know him, you're like, knowing 03, it's like he was just doing this or this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he slipped up whenever this is going on. It's like he's not an ill-intentioned dude, but you also will never cross this man like in any part of California or Atlanta or anywhere. People respect the shit Texas.
Yeah,
people respect the shit out of 03 Greedo. But like seeing him go away was like made it so clear that before that time, it's like anything else is just bullshit right now. And
yeah.
Thank God everyone around me, from my girlfriend to my manager to my parents, to whoever, like understood that. That was like, if Greedo calls me, it's like there's nothing above that right now.
Yeah.
And like his JPay is on my Twitter right now. If you're trying to reach Greedo, tell him like how you feel about him, send him something, send him some bread, whatever it is. It's like you can find that info on my page. And he's still very much, I don't want to talk about him like he's not still Greedo. You know what I'm saying? It's like you're going to not be not hearing from him. So much music coming in. It's like, from what I understand, the way all this courtship is going, we might see him a lot sooner than we think.
You know
what
I mean?
It would be great. So like, to me, it's just about keeping Greedo alive. So when he does come back, he can come right back. You know
yeah.
what I'm saying? And like, I think for a lot of people, you always have that shot. Bobby's going to have that shot.
Mm-hmm.
Mac's going to have that shot. Like mm-hmm. when they come back, if their first song has fucking Tekashi on it or whatever the fuck, it's like
right.
people going to pay attention to that first song no matter what. And if you come out hard and you come out crazy, it's like, you might be able to walk back into your career, walk back into people really paying attention to your music. And Greedo is someone where I feel like he's such a timeless artist. There's no question whether if we get to see Greedo anytime soon, he's going to be able to pick up right where he fucking left off.
How does Vince Staples come into your life?
Ooh.
I was making beats with my phone down just like this for like an hour, and I flip my phone over and there's like 20 missed calls, like random numbers. Hey, this is blah, blah, blah from Def Jam. Like, hey, this is whoever from fucking downtown. Like, do you think you'd want to get in with Van? And then at the bottom of all that shit was a DM from Vince that said, what's up, black man? And so I ignored all the texts. I just fucking, I DM Vince back and I was like, yo, I have like a cave in Burbank. I never leave it. I do everything here. Like, pull up. And he was like, all right, I'm on my way. So I answered back all these people. They're like, how's Wednesday at 3? Like, how's like, what do you think about next week on Tuesday? I'm just like, Vince is coming here right now. And they're like, oh, great. Like, sounds awesome. Vince came. I tried to flex. Like, anytime I walk into a room, my goal when I get the aux is like, let me just shit on y'all real quick. I'm about to play the coolest song I have on my computer, the thing I'm the most proud of. And so Vince comes in. I'm like, all right, I'm going to play you a little bit of this, play you some of this. This man is bored in my studio. Like, does not care. You know, I'm trying to flex all this Atlanta shit, all this other shit I'm doing. And then I play All Black and the tone changed. And like Vince grabbed his homie's arm and fucking started asking me if I understood what Black was saying on songs and shit. And I was like, oh, we hit a note here with something. And then after that, he's like, let me play you something. And he played me some shit he had ready. And slowly Vince started to unfold FM to me, and he had it in his head. And like, Vince is the kind of guy where knows what his next three projects sound like, let alone this one.
Yeah.
And he's just so dialed in and he's so smart. And like, at first I thought like, okay, I'm just helping Vince get together whatever kind of stuff he wants to get together. He's asking for these types of beats, these types of songs, these type of tempos, whatever it is. And then slowly, as the sessions went on, like him and I got closer, more conversations started happening, and he started explaining to me the arc of the project and that it was going to be conceptual and that it was going to have these kind of tie-ins and all this different stuff. And every time he would open up a little piece to me, I'd get so, I'm like, oh, well, do you need me to do this? Like, do you want me to sequence these two things? Like, da 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 da. And I was just trying to help however I could, because I was like, I can't believe this is what Vince is on. You know what I'm saying? Because it was, people are always like, are all shocked. Like, oh, he took this left route. He's on much more commercial stuff. It sounds much more like relevant than all the really avant-garde things he was doing on Big Fish or this and that. And it's like, he knows you're going to say this about him. And it's like, he's using that to his advantage. And also there's layers to FM that people will figure out in a year or two as he does more things. And like being able to be a part of something like that was so valuable and just so eye-opening for me, because this year, as much as I'm working with a lot of big people and a lot of great people, I feel like I'm always coming in there like, well, what about this concept? And how about we try to flesh this out and da da da. And that's the excitement I bring to so many projects. And being able to like spar with Vince, who's versed in this and really has like his feet dug into like doing these kinds of projects on a bigger level than I have, it really just, I was just felt honored to be a part of it. And shout out to Corey Smith, Vince's manager,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, like, shout out to Corey.
Corey is just like, gives you so much game without even meaning to, you know? And they don't, there's no pats on the back around there. There's no like, oh, this shit's super hard. Like, oh, we're killing it. Oh, this is going to be the big, like, there's none of that. You know what I mean? It's like, let's go there. Let's make this music and let's do this at the highest level. And even with the, like, the project coming out and how I talk about it and how we let people know how the project went, it's like, it's way different than anything else I'm doing. You know what I mean? Because you don't want to give people everything and you don't want people to even know the mystique of the genius that goes on with that team. And I'm just happy to be a part of it, man.
So Key was just on Fader.
Yeah.
And he said that if asked to be on a desert island with either Post Malone or you, he would choose Post Malone because you guys...
Dude. I would kill him too so much. Fast. I would murder Key so fast. Quick.
So he's smart to not want you on the island.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. Oh, my God.
Wait, what's the dumbest thing you guys have argued about?
You're going to get into this? the dumbest thing we've argued about ever. It's so much stuff. Like, one time, Key got me a shirt as a present. And was like, bro, I got you this Heron Preston shirt. She was like $600, like da 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 da, and like brought it and like showed it to me. And I was like, all right, hold on, I'll get it from you later, whatever. The next day I see him, I'm like, bro, can I get that shirt? Like, I'm out of clean shirts in New York. And he was like, oh, I gave it to the laundry dude to do my laundry at the hotel. And I'm like, what? Like, I thought it was a gift. Like, you showed it to me that you were giving it. Like, I didn't even, like, I'm not like expecting anything, but like you presented it to me. And I was like, just hold on to it. He's like, nah, he told me he'd do all my laundry if I gave it to him. And I'm like, Key, what? Like, he wouldn't not eat a filet mignon in this one interview. We had this one interview, and he was just like, nah. He's like, He had a filet mignon and a croissant, and he made a sandwich, and he was like, I'm eating this right now. And, like, we were felt like they're, like, putting the mics on, the cameras, and he's just, like, the first, like, when you see the interview, the first thing, he just takes this big-ass bite of a filet mignon croissant sandwich that he made. I'm just like, dude, why?
Talk about the All Black Project real quick, if you could, if you'd like. Whatever.
He's my favorite thing out of Northern California. I think there's so much just intense ambition behind Black, and I think for a long time he never had a producer who could stand up to him or would stand up to him or would tell him, like, say that how you mean it, say that how you like you're performing it. Like, Black's lines are already so jarring and his topics are already really, really, like, insane, and he has a lot of lingo and metaphors and sports double entendres for talking about street shit, and it's already hard to decode. So I'm like, let's make this a little less cryptic, and let's really, if you have a question, it should be upwards inflection when you say it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, let's put these little ad libs of, like, all the shit you be saying around your friends and all the little personality shit. Because if you listen to, like, Canadian Goose and you listen to other Black songs that got people's attention, it's not one ad lib. And also, if you listen to the difference in the timbre of his voice on 2 Minute Drills and on those projects, you hear him rapping like this on those projects. It's a little bit of shit on our project. It sound like this. You feel me? Like, it's, you see the pop in the vocal. And I knew he had that in him. And so there's never a time where a bar goes by where I let him coast. Also, with this California shit, whether it's Vince or Greedo or Shoreline Mafia or Dom Kennedy or whoever, the style of recording out there is so different than it is in Atlanta or in anywhere else. And, like, Atlanta really set the tone, I feel like, with everywhere, with just punching in. Punching in, it, I feel like, is not only, like, the most common way a lot of people record songs, whether they write it that way or not, but to me, it's the most efficient. Mm-hmm. And whether you're someone like Black, who will write your whole verse and go in there and punch your whole verse, like, mm-hmm. same way SOBRB, like, they'll punch yep. whole verses. I'm like, bro, if your next bar is really a punchline, you're really trying to get across about the concept of this song or just something within this verse, how are we gonna have the time or even, like, the energy to pay attention to what you just said if you're so winded about getting to the next bar and getting your next line out that you didn't have time to really emphasize all that? And it's as simple as just holding out a word or, like, little shit where it's just like you can hear these extra inflections and it's more personality and it paints the picture a little better. And with Black, you really need to paint the picture for people. Like, 2 Minute Drills, our project, that's when it's the 29th and you don't have rent yet and you got to run a drill. You know what I mean? That's when it's like, you don't know how you're going to fix this problem you have, but you got to make it work. This kind of shit we were talking about earlier, like, yeah. when I was an intern, it's like, that's what 2 Minute Drills means to Black. And everything he's talking about on there sounds like a football thing or like John Madden. But when he says, if I can't run that bitch, I'm going past it, he's not talking about playing football and a lot of shit.
Hold on.
Like, I heard somebody, when I was at a TDE session one time, and I heard somebody say, if the song title is cryptic and all your bars in the song are cryptic and the visual is cryptic and everything about it is all these different layers to try to show someone this really crazy thing you thought up and got across, they're going to miss the point if you don't give them something to hold on to. You know what I'm saying? It's mm-hmm. like if there's mystique everywhere, then there's nothing to be excited about.
No.
But dude, like,
cause explain Zorro to me.
Damn. But like, I feel like Zorro would like put it down if he had to. Like, Zorro.
Oh, he does. Oh, yeah. I meant for like the ladies, but like Zorro's out here killing it. But I'm saying there's mystique.
If you had an opportunity to work with a legend,
Zorro.
Yeah. Snoop, right? Like, somebody who's just like got an impeccable catalog, who has so many years, who knows what he's doing. You've worked with a lot of younger artists. You've been able to bring something different to the table. Could you do something cool for Snoop?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, good.
I just got to have vision for it. Like, people bring people to the studio all the time. I get all these big DMs from people all the time. It's like, if I don't have a vision, there's no point in me doing it.
Right.
Because I'm just bringing you hot beats.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do that. It's like someone like Snoop, him specifically, when I think about it, it's like, I think about Beautiful and I think about Drop It Like It's Hot. And I think about, that's an era where it's like he came back already in that era. Mm-hmm. And there was no contention. It was like, these are fucking great songs.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, I feel like that's always possible.
Listen, we're thrilled for you. We know so much of your story because in ways it's not dissimilar to ours.
Right.
We grew up 5 minutes from you. We interned. We came into a game as outsiders and went about doing the work in the right way. And look, we're all sitting here right now, but but at your peak, you took it in stride, and when you were down to your last thousand, you had belief because you knew that your friends were bumping your music. So we're excited about your career, not just for the last year, but everything before and everything coming up and for us coming up.
Yes. And no,
we have a flight to catch.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to come back.
So please come back.
Because like we do have to talk more about Connecticut.
Yes.
And I want to talk about where you were when you heard Jadakiss diss 50 for being from Connecticut.
Is your last DJ gig at Arch Street? We want to know all this stuff.
Yeah.
But sincerely, congratulations on everything. You made it a long, long way from Connecticut, even though it's just up the Merritt Parkway and, you know,
thank you guys.
A couple stops in the Metro North.
Well, honestly, I've been following you guys since then. And I really do have a lot of respect for your guys' opinion and how you guys feel about things. And, like, I try to bring that same level of knowledge and level of backup, and like I can fact check what I'm talking about, and I make sure I don't talk about it otherwise. And that's something I got from dudes like you. So thank y'all.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
All right, man.
Thanks everyone for listening to this new episode of Waste Time with It's the Real Jeff. People want to find out more about us. I'm Eric, the one with the curly hair. You are Jeff, the one who is not sick but does have glasses. Jeff, people want to find out more about this podcast called A Waste of Time with It's the Real. If people want to find out more about what's going on, where can they go?
You can always go to itsthereal.com. Go to itsthereal.com for all of your It's the Real needs, including our merch, which is at itsthereal.com/shop, and also our podcast, which can also be streamed on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud. Search for A Waste of Time with It's the Real, or go to soundcloud.com/awasteoftime. Or if you're looking for Two Jews and Two Black Dudes, our side podcast for the Lox, it's at soundcloud.com/2JewsTwoBlackDudes. You can also find our music on Spotify and all other streaming services. And we are also on
Instagram, Facebook, even though they're down, right?
Facebook and Instagram are down right now.
Yeah, but go to Twitter, find us at It's the Real.
Yeah. Jeff, we'd love to shout people out, especially for the fact that they love our product and spread the word about our podcast, our rhyme book, our t-shirt, our music, our live shows, whatever it is, they're on board and they are supportive, and we'd love to shout them out, especially right here on the podcast, not just out in the world. Jeff, who do you want to shout out today?
I want to shout out Tony MC Santano.
Oh, that's who I was going to shout out, but go ahead.
All right, well, we ran into him down in Miami. Shout out to Tony MC. He definitely recommended some good food, which we did not take up this time, but we will take up the next time we are down there in Miami. We went to Versailles for some fire Cuban food.
Tony is the nicest guy in the world, and we knew that from interacting with him on Twitter. He is a huge proponent of us and our podcast, and it was so dope that he found us down there in Miami. He works for 99 Jams. Shout out to everyone over there, and especially to our guy, Tony MC. Jeff, I would like to shout out our friend Brian Kraft. We went down to South Florida. We thought, let's hit up a native South Floridian, one of our good friends who's been to our live show, who's a huge supporter of us, who's copped some t-shirts, who is just the greatest person. We would love to catch up with him and his wife. Let's call our friend and see what he's doing. And he said,
I live 3.5 hours away.
So shout out to Brian Kraft. The next time we are remotely in the area, if we're in state, we're going to hit you up. And we love the fact that you consulted with your wife and said, hey, maybe we'll make that drive and we'll go see the guys, even though that's the craziest idea in the world. We appreciate you, Brian Kraft. Jeff, anything else?
Well, we'll see if Eric gets better.
We'll go buy some t-shirts, make him feel better. As always, guys, not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
See you guys next week. Right.